We need a change. And for the first time, it appears as though the Carter administration promises some help in the area of Medicaid. Help that we need so desperately because the tax burden continues to rise in every single city and county. We need a cap on Medicaid. We should have been working for that, working to change that situation a long time ago. And not only is it the welfare formula that penalizes it, but it's the fact that we allow and we have allowed for not just this year or last year, but for 25 years, certain states to literally push their poor to the Northeast and to New York in particular. What am I talking about? Does it make sense to have a system where a family of four can draw benefits of $370 a month as an allowance, and then another state only provides $47 a month, the state of Mississippi, literally pushing its poor and the nation's poor from the South to the Northeast? And that's what we've seen take place. Where have our legislative leaders in the Congress been, both Democrats and Republicans, fighting to change this? Where have the Javits's and the Holtzman's philosophy been, using that clout, using that power, using that so-called seniority, or using the fact that someone is in the majority in their party to change an inequitable system so that the working middle-class taxpayers of this state could see real jobs developed, so that instead of laying off police in other areas throughout this state, in Buffalo, in Rochester, in Syracuse, in New York City, and that's what's going to take place if the revenue-sharing formulas aren't continued, and that's what's taking place in New York, so that the essential services could be maintained rather than have this heavy burden placed upon the local municipalities and the working middle-class people of this state.
Mr. Javits, your rebuttal?
The matter of welfare catches us in a catch-22. I think that people like my opponent, Mr. D'Amato, give the feeling, because it's all so general and he's never had the responsibility in the Congress, throw out the baby with the bath, that the United States, including the middle class, doesn't have a heart for people who are really in trouble and really need some form of government relief. And on the other hand, there are a good many people who are mawkish about this thing and are unwilling to set strict standards regarding work where they're able to do it, and a good many legislators who won't go for the daycare solution, which will employ not thousands, but probably some millions of women. Now, people like myself fight against that constantly, and we have some successes. For example, it is possible to get some help in New York for concentrations of the poor in respect of education. The whole anti-poverty program, which is now in effect to a very substantial extent, gives help in the welfare field to redeem people from the welfare syndrome. The concept of rewarding the working poor who are most deserving in respect of the tax system, which I have worked on, which has been successful to some extent, helps. But this struggle must continue. And Mr. D'Amato has the privilege of not having had any such responsibility, and not having had to work, and not having anything to deliver. He can promise anything. You'll see him after election, and then he's in for 6 years. I say those things not to be harsh, but because I deeply believe that the public should understand and evaluate the considerations which affect those who've given many, many years of dedicated service to a problem like this. And just one point about health care. In rebuttal. Again, this happens to be, again, Mr. D'Amato's view, on catastrophic care from the federal government. Now, that's one of the biggest deceptions that I know of, because it doesn't call for a contribution from anybody. It calls for federal government pay to the highest risks without, as in the insurance principle, carrying the risk with a generality of people who are insured, which is the way in which I would approach it.
Ms. Holtzman, your turn.
Thank you. We have had in New York State a great tradition of senators. Senator Robert Wagner Sr., Senator Herbert Lehman, Senator Robert Kennedy, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. These are people about whom no question of integrity was raised. But questions have been raised about the integrity of Mr. D'Amato. In 1979, a grand jury in Nassau County found that taxpayers' monies were placed in non-interest-bearing accounts, and that the people of Nassau County and the people of the town of Hempstead lost millions of dollars as a consequence. Even though I've asked you, Mr. D'Amato, over the past two debates to tell the people of New York State when, if ever, those monies were placed in interest-bearing accounts, you've not responded. Another question was raised by the State Investigations Commission, which in 1978 found that in Nassau County, taxpayers' dollars were used in a system of political payoffs to insurance brokers. Hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayers' money went into the pockets of insurance brokers who did little or nothing for that. In the words of the Investigations Commission, the public officials in Nassau County are the trustees of these dollars, but they have failed to meet their responsibility, and nearly $4,000 have been allowed to be distributed to a few insiders. You are named in that report, Mr. D'Amato. At best, you are silent about this massive practice of political abuse of taxpayers' dollars. At worst, you are part of the problem. The people of New York have a right to expect the highest standard of integrity from their elected officials, and I'm sure that in this case, they will expect that.
We've reached the halfway mark in this debate among the major candidates for the office of United States Senator from New York State, and the topics will now shift to those in the areas of foreign policy and national defense. May we have the first question, please?
I am Lori Smith from West Sand Lake. My question is, how far do you think the United States should go to preserve the flow of Middle East oil to our country?
Mr. Javits, you're first.
I speak here with a deep sense of responsibility because the length of time that the people of New York have kept me in the Senate, 24 years, has made me the ranking member of the Committee on Foreign Relations. I believe that one of the most critical interests of the United States is to maintain the flow of Middle East oil. We still need 50% of it, and by the way, the heaviest impacted are those of us here in the Northeast, including New York. And Europe draws 80% or more, and Japan draws 100%. The industrialized world and the developing world are both at the mercy of this flow. And therefore, to the extent that prudence will allow, in the terms that I'm about to use, there is no action that we can take that is more critical to our national interest than to keep that flow going. And in my judgment, one of the major problems we have right now, this minute, is to see that Iran, notwithstanding the fact that it's acted like a complete outlaw in respect of the hostages, is not dismembered by the Soviet Union and Iraq. And secondly, we have got to bring our allies, and that includes the NATO allies, into the same position of responsibility with respect to that flow that we have. And they've got to share that responsibility, and we've got to make that number one priority. And lastly, we must so position our military forces that to the extent prudence will allow and to the extent the Congress will allow, under the War Powers Resolution, of which I'm the author, the United States may be in the position to take whatever action, as I say, prudence will permit in terms of protecting that oil flow. Those are the three criteria which I believe we
must
follow.
Thank you. Mr. D'Amato.
I believe it's absolutely paramount that the world's oil supply, particularly that that comes from the Middle East, continue, and that by the use of our own strategic weapon system, by positioning our carriers, by putting our aircraft in a position, by making sure that those bases that are open to us will and have been open to us so that in the event it is necessary to use them, that we have the ability to do so, that we demonstrate a very real commitment, not just a make-believe commitment, not just a posturing, that we, along with our allies, will do what is necessary to ensure that the flow of oil continues. I think more important is the fact that this nation has an absolute obligation to see to it that it becomes energy independent, so that in the future this kind of situation can be avoided, so that we're not held at the mercy of whether it's the oil sheiks or the OPEC nations. I think that it is so important that we move towards energy independence by reliance on atomic energy and the conversion of coal and synthetic fuels, by conservation programs, by developing alternative sources of energy, by seeing to it that sophisticated drilling methods are employed so that this nation can bring up oil and gasoline or gas from areas that may be more difficult at the present time. We must have a sound conventional ground force, a sound conventional strategic force, adequate transportation, and indeed, we've got to convince our allies that when we take a position, that we will stand behind it. And this way, maybe our allies will begin to develop trust and faith in our commitments. To date, they lack that. To date, when we...
in the Department of Defense. I'll give you an example that took place in Brooklyn, New York. We have a Navy resale office that hires 700 people and does $2.2 billion worth of business. Several years ago, the Pentagon wanted to move that facility to Illinois, not to save money and not to enhance the nation's security, but because a congressman in Illinois had just become chairman of the Armed Services Committee and he didn't have a military facility in his district. And of course, that was a shame, because you can't have a chairman of a committee of the armed services without a military facility in his district. So the Navy was prepared to waste hundreds of thousands, if not millions of taxpayers' dollars to move this facility from Brooklyn to Illinois. Well, we did our homework, I did my homework, and we stopped the move. We can't afford that kind of waste, and we can't afford that kind of political decision-making. Our nation's defense is too important for that.
Thank you. Mr. Javits.
Ms. Holtzman has been laboring in this campaign constantly to explain why she has, during her 8 years in the Congress, voted against every single authorization for defense in terms of materiel. The present answer which he gave to this question is simply part of the same syndrome, and I cannot for the life of me understand it, and therefore I have dubbed it on her part dangerous naivete in terms of the security of the United States, and I repeat that until she can explain adequately such a strange vacuum in the thinking of one who aspires to be a senator of the United States. Certainly there should be complete fiscal accountability in the Defense Department, and we have the opportunity to vote yea or nay on every single weapon system that the Pentagon proposes. And I've suffered very serious attacks in the primary campaign from Mr. D'Amato because I had the courage and also studied very hard in order to oppose certain weapon systems like the B-1 bomber, which I called a turkey and which still is a turkey and which would have cost us over $30 billion if we were foolish enough to buy it. So you've got to have a clear eye in the Congress as to what you want, the constitutional provision that the civilian should control the military, which is carried out there in these authorization and appropriation bills, is a very sound protection for freedom in our country. And if the people return me to the Senate, I will insist on fiscal responsibility, but I'll also call them as I see them on these weapon systems and on the general policy toward individual defense items of our country.
Mr. D'Amato.
Absolutely. Fiscal accountability is a cornerstone in government, a cornerstone whether it's in the Defense Department or any other. But when someone votes continually in the negative at every single time for every single appropriation, regardless what the weapon system is, votes against replacing antiquated transportation systems, and votes no with only two other colleagues joining her, then something is wrong. When someone says that they're for a strong defense, and yet they vote against adequate flight pay to retain pilots, something's wrong. That's not voting against waste. It's voting against a strong defense, a strong, balanced, conventional, as well as strategic defense. I differ sharply and greatly with the Holtzman-Javits philosophy, particularly Ms. Holtzman. When Senator Javits calls the B-1 bomber a turkey and the giveaway of the Panama Canal something in the interest of this nation, I disagree. Let's look at what the B-1 bomber would have done. It would have replaced an antiquated 25-year-old B-52. We send up our boys in those airplanes, boys who are indeed younger than some of the planes they're called upon to fly. That's not a strategic weapon. And when we talk about converting the B-52, it will cost close to $60 million to make the conversion so that it's capable of firing the cruise missile and in terms of maintenance. And we still have an antiquated plane. We still have a plane that is susceptible to rockets and ground attack. We still have a plane that doesn't meet the strategic capabilities and needs of this nation. And so I think it's the Javits-Holtzman philosophy of failing to represent the mainstream of thinking in this country, and that is people want a strong, well-balanced defense. They don't want waste. They don't want extravagance. I'm not for the race car system that would pull the missiles around and hide them, and I don't think the people are, but I am for a strong defense.
We've come to the rebuttal period on questions of foreign policy and national defense. What have you to say about your opponent's arguments? Ms. Holtzman, you're first.
I think that the voters of this state are going to be deeply concerned about qualities of character and qualities of ability in deciding who they want as their next senator. I think they're going to be looking for qualities of hard work. And I'm proud to say that I won an award for being Workhorse of the Year from Washingtonian Magazine. They're going to be looking for qualities of integrity. And I think the people of the state ought to know that on the Abscam tapes, I'm told that an indicted member of Congress says, don't even try and bribe that Liz Holtzman. She's too honest to trust. People are also going to be looking for qualities of independence. They're going to be looking for a person who is prepared to stand up, and I am prepared to stand up. Indeed, I am the only candidate running for the United States Senate who's prepared to stand up to the oil companies and to say, let's reimpose controls on the price of gas and oil. I'm prepared to stand up to the Pentagon and say, let's eliminate waste. I'm prepared to stand up to the insurance companies and say, let's reduce the price of automobile insurance to New Yorkers. And we are among the hardest pressed and the highest paying drivers in the country. I have stood up to presidents of the United States. I'm proud to have participated in the Watergate impeachment inquiry during the Nixon era. I'm proud to have asked the tough questions about the Ford pardon when those were asked. I'm proud even to have challenged a president of my party when I disagreed with him, because I am someone who will put principle above politics. And I think those are the qualities that people are looking for in a United States senator, because we will have tough times in the 1980s. We are living in a dangerous world. We have tough issues of foreign policy. We've got to pull together with our allies and in some cases get tough with them. We've got to develop energy independence. We have got to make sure that the defense of this nation is secure. These are tough issues. They won't be solved with sloganeering. They will be solved with thoughtful, diligent, and independent approach to the issues. That's what I offer the people of this state.
Thank you. Mr. D'Amato, your turn for rebuttal.
I think sloganism is not called for in terms of the next United States senator. I think candor. I think ready to face the people in these kinds of formats and debates. And I'm wondering why Ms. Holtzman has just turned down two debates, October 31st, Syracuse League of Women Voters, and giving the people an opportunity to see and hear us. Is it because she really can't answer the questions on her record? I'm wondering why she's turned down a debate the following day in Buffalo. I don't know whether Senator Javits has learned of this, but just today, We've learned of these turndowns, long scheduled in advance. I think the people have a right to know why. You have voted against every single military appropriation. We're not talking about exotic weapon systems. We're talking about pay. Pay increases to retain nuclear engineers. Pay increases to retain pilots. Enough money to buy transportation systems, munitions. Enough money so that those in the military aren't forced, like tens of thousands, to rely on food stamps. How can you be for a strong defense when you take a posture totally against? It's inconceivable. The record doesn't stand up. And when you close by talking about energy independence, let me cite to you a record. There are millions of taxpayers right within New York State who, in an effort to have and bring about energy independence and conservation, have brought in new heating systems, weather stripping, new kinds of solar devices and paneling so that they could conserve. And Congress wisely adopted legislation that would permit tax credits. And I ask those in the audience, think about how many of you have taken advantage of this opportunity to save and to conserve. And those tax credits mean a lot to hardworking middle-class taxpayers. And Ms. Holtzman, on two occasions, back in 75 and then in 77, voted no on both occasions. Ms. Holtzman, you talk about energy independence and you vote against the conversion of coal into usable power, against nuclear and non-nuclear development and experimentation, against drilling, against deep water ports so that we can bring in the big tankers and hold the cost down. Yours is nothing more than political pap when you say that we were going to hold the prices down and elect me. We've elected you and you haven't done it. And I would suggest that both my colleagues have a somewhat naive policy when it comes to rewarding enemies, rewarding Nicaragua, sending $75 million to a country that has suspended human rights and has incarcerated 35,000 people today. I say that our allies want us to be strong and know that we're going to stand to our commitments, and that the forgotten middle class is entitled to a free, strong economic society and a strong military.
Mr. Javits, your rebuttal.
For 24 years, I've represented the people of this state. And for 24 years, they have enabled me to acquire security, to acquire seniority, to acquire influence in the Senate of the United States. And today, when you review the newspapers of this state, which have almost uniformly, in terms of our cities, endorsed me for another term in the Senate of the United States, I say to the people of New York, this would be wasting a great asset as far as they're concerned. It was not easy for me to agree to run, but I did because of the grave dangers we face, including the danger of survival. When this campaign began, I felt very deeply that ultimately the question would turn to peace. The people of our country are rather unsure about both presidential candidates. Now, in me, they've got a cool and very experienced head in the foreign policy of this country. And if they've elected and reelected me for four times, isn't it fair to say that one of the big reasons has been that they think I have something on the ball in terms of how to keep the peace? And in addition, I am the author of the War Powers Resolution. For the first time in 200 years, the Congress is able to restrain a president by deploying our troops to some area where there are hostilities or imminent danger of hostilities from putting us in war. And we've had over 100 such situations in our history, including Vietnam, I might point out, one of the most unpopular wars that this country ever fought. And so isn't it time to sweep aside the cobwebs? Isn't it time to take the criteria which Ms. Holtzman and Mr. D'Amato both pick out, independence, work, effectiveness, knowledgeability, experience, and I might say, very adequate help to do this job, and say, we've got a man. He's on the job. He's got the seniority it'll take these people a quarter of a century to get. Let's keep him on the job and reelect him to the United States Senate.
Thank you. This concludes the debate, I'm sad to say. I'm sure you valued the opportunity of hearing and seeing the major candidates for the
budget daily, and I believe the purpose that is inherent in the disclosure will be served. That is, the public will be advised as it votes that this is a factor to be cranked into its decision about a particular candidate.
Right now, one other point he made in a speech in Watertown last night. And he said that in the beginning of this hostage situation, President Carter should have come out and bombed Iraq. What's your feeling there? You've got a lot to do with foreign policy.
I have had a lot to do with foreign policy. And bombing Iran indiscriminately, which is what this implies, would have, in my judgment, resulted in chaos, not only in Iran, but in the whole Middle East, and for probably the destruction of many of the very, very great damage to Europe and Japan and the United States, which still draws 50% of its oil from the opening country. Now, what I have said, which I think makes infinitely more sense, is that if we had engaged in hot pursuit immediately, that is, an Entebbe-type effort to free the hostages pinpointed to that situation, then the decision might have been a very wise one, but it would have jeopardized lives. There's no question about it. We could easily have had losses among the hostages. And no one could have made that decision except if you were actually in the job as President of the United States. Certainly I was close enough to it because I, like the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, was constantly consulted. But the decision was the president's, and whether he decided right or wrong, only God knows. Therefore, as it's his authority, we simply cannot challenge what was done. But that was another route. But bombing, I think, indiscriminate bombing of Iran would have been an absolute shambles, and there was no solution.
Do you agree with Mr. Carter that we should not be too optimistic about the hostages possibly coming home this weekend?
Everything is so uncertain in respect to Iran, and the power struggles there lend uncertainty to an uncertain situation, that I think it would be a grave mistake for the people of our country to have illusions about how many slips there are between the discussions, which are obviously taking place, not necessarily directly, but indirectly, and the safe return of the hostages. But I don't suppose human beings, including myself, can fail to be wishfully hoping that at long last this terrible agony may come to a close.
Senator, do you think that Mr. D'Amato acted responsibly when he called the bombing of Iran on the eve of the possible release of the hostages?
Well, I think that everybody in the world, even those fanatics who are running affairs in Iran, realizes that such a call from one candidate for the United States Senate in New York doesn't make a governmental policy. So I doubt that anything will come of that. And no one ever pretended that Mr. D'Amato is an expert in or knows much about the foreign policy of the United States, least of all I. Thank you.
I'm asking to the people here to make a brief statement in terms of why they're supporting the senator and why they think he's the best candidate in this race, and then the senator will close with some remarks about women's issues. Thank you. I'm Barbara Green. The first organization endorsement will be by the Independent Black Women's Political Caucus, represented by Eugenia Gordon. Followed by that is Ann Huebner, who's president of the New York Ripon Society, then Carol Lamberg, who's staff director of the New York Housing Conference, and Rita Hauser, who's a partner at Strug, Strug & Levan. There are a couple of other people who are expected. If they come, we'll introduce them. If not, the senator will indicate some of the other women who have agreed to serve on his committee.
I'm W. Lugenia Gordon from the Independent Black Women's Political Caucus. And as you know, the Independent Black Women are just that, independent. We are not tied into no particular party. We are Black women who wants to be involved in power politics. We do not want to be used by any party, but we speak out for whom we like, and a lot of times we speak out for people because we know that person is in our corner. Senator Javits is one of the people that represent New York State that the Black women feel that any time that anything go wrong, we can call him and he respond to us, not asking us what party we are in or do we vote. Another reason the Independent Black Women Political Caucus is endorsing Senator Javits is that we know most of us is from the South, and we know the Southern politicians and the Southern voters are more astute than the New Yorkers. I can tell you because I know the South kept Sparkman, Eastland, Rankins in. And I was a child in Alabama and was praying for them to die and they got healthier. They kept them there till they had to almost roll them in. Senator Javits, I wished I had his health, believe me. And I'm for one that would like to see him stay there till we have to take him in on a wheelchair. Because believe me, when you look around and see who has the brains and see who is dedicated, the older people has the knowledge. He's been around long enough to know what is happening, and he's ahead of some of those powerful committees. And another thing, when a freshman get there, he's nothing. He has to ask permission, can he go outside? So what I'm saying, that I hope all New York voters will say, let's keep in a man that is there and has the power to move and stop talking about his age, because I'm getting old too. Age has nothing to do with brains. Age has nothing to do with conscience. It gives you more understanding of the people, and I'd like to let you turn this over now to Mrs. Florence Rice. And hope, and believe me, I hope he wins. And I know he will. Thank you.
Well, I want to say that Senator Javits, we certainly endorse. I remember a number of years ago, now as a Black woman, that it was Senator Javits that brought the first Black page boy into the Senate. And that to us was a remarkable thing at that time. I am saying the same thing that Mrs. Gordon is saying. We want to keep Senator Javits there. We know that it seems to us, those of us who are a little bit knowledgeable, that I would rather see someone there that knows, and anyone knows politics, know politics is a game, and you better know the game.